In the news.
Good morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
So it's week number two, and we got a lot of topics that have popped up over the last 5 or 6 days, and we want to, we're kind of going to go macro, you know, broad level, international stuff, down to relatively micro. We'll talk a little bit about the legislative session. So let's start big. A lot of news on the international front. Vote in Great Britain.
Yep, today's the vote.
All right, so Professor McDaniel and I actually do a lot of work on elections and politics. Obviously, our focus is the United States, but this is an interesting election. The British elections, y'all are probably aware there have been some really significant changes in Britain over the last 3 or 4 years. The British voted to leave the European Union, the so-called Brexit, British exit vote a couple of years ago. And now the current Prime Minister, Prime Minister May, who is a conservative, is the second female Prime Minister of Great Britain after Margaret Thatcher, kind of sensed that there was an opportunity about 4 weeks ago, given the state of the Labour Party, which is sort of the left of centre party in Great Britain, that there was an opportunity to expand her majority in the House of Commons, which is the main legislative body in Great Britain. And so, unlike in the United States, where you have a regular schedule to elections, in Great Britain, the executive and the legislative leader are the same person, right? The leader of the majority party is the prime minister, and the prime minister has all the power. There is no president in Great Britain. So as you guys are looking at the constitutional arrangements that exist in the United States, these discussions of judiciary, legislative, and executive, and the powers therein, keep in mind the United States, the way we do things in the United States is somewhat unusual. A lot of countries have followed our model, but the British have their own pattern that sort of evolved over time, where essentially it's a unitary system, as Professor McDaniel mentioned several times in lecture. So there are no states and localities in Great Britain the way there are in the United States. There's only sort of national government, and there's a couple local mayors and things like that, but they're relatively powerless. All right, so there's a national government, it's a unitary system, and there's no real division of power the way there is in the United States, no checks and balances. Right? If you have a majority in the legislative body, you control all the executive and bureaucratic functions in the country. And so Prime Minister May sees an opportunity to consolidate her position and the position of the Conservative Party. Now, things have gotten complicated. Her lead in the polls has been diminishing over the leader of the Labour Party. The Labour Party, by the way, right now is considered to be somewhat in disarray. Their leader is pretty unpopular. He's not well regarded within his own party, let alone nationally. But, you know, it's a tumultuous time, and it's not clear that anybody who's in charge of the status quo is going to do particularly well. On top of that, you also have the terrorist attacks in London over the last couple of weeks, you know, leading to questions, even though May, you know, is a leader of sort of a harder line, a party that takes a harder line with respect to terrorism, there's some dissatisfaction with the way the government has handled the situation there with respect to immigration and homegrown terrorist threats and terrorist threats from abroad. So it's complicated, but it's going to be very interesting to watch. So if you guys have an opportunity, you know, go to BBC America or just take a look online and see how those votes come in. People are going to look at that as a harbinger, as a predictor of something broader that might be occurring across Europe and maybe even felt over here at some point.
Yeah, I mean, because if you think about the, it's really interesting what's happened in response to the Manchester attacks as well as the attacks in London. And many people have argued that the election in France was a sign that this kind of populist or a response that you're seeing within the U.S. as well as in Great Britain really was not going to make it through the rest of Europe, and that the European Union might be able to survive. Because if Macron had not won in France, there was a really a good case that France may have pulled out the European Union, and it would have imploded.
Yeah, let's go back a little bit so y'all are kind of familiar. The last kind of big national elections that we've seen recently, certainly in Europe, were in France, where you had you have a two-round system. France does have a president. They also have a parliament, a Congress. But they have a prime minister as well as a president, and a president with fairly substantial powers. So, but they have a two-round election in France. And what happened in France was that Marie Le Pen, who is the leader of the National Front, which is a very conservative kind of, well, conservative is not even the right word, sort of a nationalist right-wing party, very, very pro-France, anti-immigrant, made it to the second round, was one of the top two vote getters. And the other person who made it was this guy, Macron, who leads sort of a centrist kind of coalitional party. And a lot of the votes that had gone to other parties' candidates went to Macron in the second round, right? So you have voting, and then a couple weeks later, you have a second round voting with only the top two people advancing. So Macron is not really a fixture of any kind of party in France. But it was an indication that the kind of populist, I guess you might even say kind of Trump-like support that existed for Le Pen and some other candidates in France had its limits. So Macron was seen as a, you know, kind of a triumph for establishment forces, more kind of, you know, traditional forces. So Macron wins in France, kind of a centrist party leader. May is leading in the polls in Great Britain, a traditional conservative party. It's, again, right of center, but at least it's one of the established political parties for people who are afraid of, you know, kind of the revolution. So we'll see how it shakes out. That's going on. There was a, obviously we talked last week about President Trump's trip to the Middle East. One of the things that fell out of that trip, there's questions about how causal these linkages are, is that seven Arab countries announced that they were isolating politically and diplomatically the state of Qatar. That's, it always took me a long time to figure out how to pronounce Qatar. Q-A-T-A-R. I used to call it Qatar. I was corrected, but no one told me what was right. So my understanding is that it's Qatar. So, you know, if you guys have corrections, please, I'm happy to learn. But Qatar has been sort of isolated by these other Arab states. Saudi Arabia, Libya, Egypt, etc. They see Qatar as basically kind of a puppet or a surrogate for the Iranians. And Trump's trip to the Middle East, in a lot of ways people saw it as a response that Obama had been cozying up to Iran. And so Trump thought that was a mistake, that Iran hadn't, you know, earned anything. Iran is a Shia-dominated regime and supports Shia insurgents in other countries. Saudi Arabia, Libya, Egypt, et cetera, these are Sunni countries. And so there's a sense on the part of the Trump people that we're better off with the Sunnis. We have more say there. Let's isolate the Iranians. The trip to the Middle East emboldened these Sunni-dominated countries to take more aggressive stance towards Qatar, who they think is an agent of Iran. Why are we talking about this in the context of an American class? Well, partially because it could be related to Trump's foreign policy, but also because the United States has significant military assets, including a sizable naval base in Qatar. And so there's a question about, you know, what happens to American defense interests and this American base in Qatar if, in fact, it becomes a political pariah. Do we shut it down? I mean, it would be very difficult to relocate this base. It's strategically kind of positioned within the Middle East. And, you know, President McDaniel was telling me he's actually has some relatives who are stationed in.
Yeah, so I had a cousin. I think it was in that area. I think the key thing he told me was 125 degrees in the shade.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. We've had colleagues who've gone to the United Arab Emirates, one or two, I believe, to Qatar also. So they're actually very interested in American expertise and engineering. You know, so that's going on in the world. Now, let's bring the focus a little closer at home. As we're taping this right now, our week two session, former FBI Director James Comey is testifying in front of the United States Senate, the Intelligence Committee, about what President Trump said to him. He released an extensive statement, basically. He gives an opening statement in his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he released at least two pages, I guess, of that statement.
I think I said seven pages altogether. Okay. He took very detailed notes of all of his meetings with President Trump.
It's a scary, scary thing. Well, as FBI director, I hope he takes notes. You know, I hope he records it, frankly. I mean, I'm old school. I want my FBI people to be kind of sneaky. You know, but the headlines that are coming out of Comey's statement, so far as we can kind of, you know, read the tea leaves, are that he says that at several points during a meeting with Trump, President Trump, is it President or President-elect Trump at the time?
I think it was President Trump.
I think it was like, President Trump.
I guess the dinner meeting they talked about was in the White House.
Right, in the White House. And so President Trump had said to him, I hope you can let this go. I think it was let it go.
Yeah.
Which is not from Frozen, although, you know, many of you may associate it with that. So he was trying to let it go, let it go. Now this is interesting. I mean, this was sort of, everything on CNN is breaking news. I'm having a hard time watching CNN right now because I keep getting tricked into thinking that there's actually breaking news all the time, but this is sort of the breaking news thing on CNN that, you know, Trump said this. There's an open question how you interpret the President of the United States telling an executive officer, I hope you can let this go. This, by the way, was a reference to Flynn, I think?
Yeah, to Flynn, yeah.
Who was a nominee at the time for a cabinet-level position, and it came out that Flynn had contacts with the Russians. So Trump was saying, you know, look, I don't think there's anything here. I hope you can just let this go. Comey, and he said, he's a great guy. He's a great guy. I hope you can let it go. And what Comey said was, I said, yeah, he's a great guy. Not I was going to let it go. So, you know, this is how Comey characterized his conversation. If you want Trump gone, then you can go obstruction of justice. See, the president is trying to, you know, use his position to threaten obliquely, you know, an executive officer who's simply trying to fulfill his constitutional duty. If you like Trump, you'd say he just is advising, you know, an executive official. He's saying, gee, I hope you can see it our way. I don't think there's anything here. You know, we'll see what the reaction is.
One of the things that that former Director Comey discussed is that I guess in the 2 months of being there with President Trump, he spoke to him, I want to say, I think 9 times total. So 2 face-to-face, 7 over the phone. Whereas with President Obama, they only spoke twice. And so people are like, why are they only speaking twice? Well, one of the reasons is people want the FBI to be independent of politics. And this is the problem Comey got into during the election, is that he painted himself as being independent of politics, but what he said mattered in politics, specifically with the Clinton investigation. Now he's getting thrown in with the Trump administration and the investigation of those officials. And one of the things you see coming out of the 70s is this really big fear that the FBI and that the Department of Justice was really a political machine. So if you think of J. Edgar Hoover, who pretty much everybody says abused his powers as director of the FBI to curtail individuals he saw as threats to the American public. And this is also why FBI directors only have short terms as well, as opposed to Hoover, who I think we had maybe over 2 decades.
Yep.
And so there's this idea of, because again, if you think about the, if the president has a lot of control over the FBI, well, then that means the president is able to use the Justice Department to punish opponents and, you know, let allies off. And this is kind of the accusation here, that you have this system which is, you know, basically going to benefit Trump supporters and hurt Trump's opponents. And it really hurts the legitimacy of the FBI to carry things out, and it hurts the legitimacy of the justice system. Yep. And so, and I guess what also made it work, so again, the idea of letting go, but then also the dinner conversation where President Trump kept asking for loyalty. And that right there might be the biggest problem. Now, is it something that's gonna sink President Trump? No. You could easily argue that, look, this is an ethics violation, or this is something that you shouldn't be doing. But it's not going to sink him at all. I think it does hurt him, and it may, it's just more ammo for people to use in the 2018 elections to try to hurt Republican candidates. The controversy may stall his domestic agenda as well, because again, he's losing a lot of political capital in doing this. And one of the biggest problems people have is, to what degree will Republicans support him? Because they realize that supporting him, they're losing political capital. They could, and so what you may end up with, he may be kind of a lame duck president quicker than you thought, because of these controversies.
I wanted to read to you guys something. So there's 2 articles I was looking at this morning on Real Clear Politics, which is sort of this news aggregation site, Real Clear Politics. I like it. It presents stuff from the left and from the right, oftentimes back to back, so you can get, you know, different points of view in a relatively efficient fashion. And there was one article by Jeffrey Toobin basically titled, If This Isn't a Smoking Gun, I Don't Know What Is. Right? So that's one statement basically saying that Comey's statement about Trump shows that Trump obstructed justice. And then right below it was an article by Alan Dershowitz, who was a Harvard law professor and ostensibly no friend of President Trump, saying that, you know, this isn't a smoking gun. I want to read you just a quick excerpt, which isn't really about the argument referent to whether Trump obstruct justice or not, but kind of a general argument to what Professor McDaniel was talking about independence within the executive, within the presidential branch. So again, Dershowitz writing about Comey. Comey did not say he would let this go. And indeed, he did not grant the president's request to do so. Nor did Comey report this conversation to the attorney general or any other prosecutor. He was troubled by what he regarded as a breach of recent traditions of FBI independence from the White House, though he recognized that, and here's the quote, this is Comey's statement, throughout history, some presidents have decided that because problems come from the Department of Justice, they should try to hold the department close. Then Dershowitz writes, that is an understatement. Throughout American history, from Adams to Jefferson to Lincoln to Roosevelt to Kennedy to Obama, presidents have directed, not merely requested, the Justice Department to investigate, prosecute or not prosecute, specific individuals or categories of individuals. It is only recently that the tradition of an independent Justice Department and FBI has emerged. But traditions, this is Dershowitz writing, but traditions, even salutary ones, cannot form the basis of a criminal charge. It would be far, so this is Dershowitz's more sort of legal argument, it would be far better if our Constitution provided for prosecutors who were not part of the executive branch, which is under the direction of the president. All right. In Great Britain, Israel, and other democracies that respect the rule of law, the director of public prosecution or the attorney general are law enforcement officials who, by law, are independent of the prime minister. But our Constitution makes the attorney general both the chief prosecutor and the chief political advisor to the president on matters of justice and law enforcement. And that's the rub. That's kind of the problem. The Department of Justice and the FBI, I guess, even in some sense, have these dual roles. They're chief law enforcement agents, but they're also the chief advisor to the president, the executive branch, and that's where it's very complicated. And so, as I said, we always have our own views on these things and takes on them, but our obligation to you guys is to try to present this context in a way that helps you figure out what you think of this. Right? So anyway, that's going on right now. The Congress continues to do or not do, what Trump wants. And I say that because it's not clear exactly, where their footing are. There's talk about Trump kind of reinvigorating his agenda with an infrastructure bill, and they're still talking about the Senate version of Obamacare or a repeal and replace on Obamacare. Our own Senator John Cornyn has said, hey, that's coming. It's going to be done by, middle of the summer. Okay. It's interesting. There's a lot of stuff that Trump has done, but in terms of legislative accomplishment, it's just so tough to get anything done right now, and it's not clear how much progress he's making on his agenda.
Yeah, the press made a big deal of the fact that he had a bunch of people around him and a photo op for signing, and people thought it was a bill signing. No, it was a signing of a memo to Congress. You clearly have a president who's trying his best to show the American public, like, look, I'm trying to get things done. I am working. But the problem is you have a number of people who just are not supporting him. And whether this is deserving or not, this is a man who's clearly trying to work back, get some political capital back, and push his agenda forward because it seems to be getting stalled. Constantly getting stalled over the Russian investigation, over all these leaks, things of that nature, one thing he did, former Director Comey did point out is that he did tell the president, you're not under investigation, and the president was like, okay, well, let everybody know that I'm not under investigation, and that is true. He said it multiple times, you're not under investigation, and the president was bothered by the fact that nothing official had come out in regards to that. And so, I mean, be truthful, if there are whispers that I had done something wrong and somebody who was like, no, you're not being investigated, but they never told anybody, I'd be a little bit bothered too. But I think the way that many people are upset about the way that President Trump handled it, and this is kind of interesting, but also one of the things we also need to admit, notice the media is having a field day with this. So while many people blame the media for the ascendancy of President Trump, His presidency will probably bring the media back into focus because people are going to be sitting there watching what's going on. When there's scandal, when there's kind of blood in the water, something like that, the media love that, and they're going to pounce on it. So CNN is with breaking news. Hey, the sun rises in the east, breaking news. Wolf Blitzer finds a canary in his beard, breaking news. It's all these types of things. They want people to pay attention. And one of the things I would advise you to be aware of is, be aware of the fact that the media is, they're for profit. And so a lot of stuff they're going to cover is they want scandal. They're looking for scandal because when things are going right, people aren't paying attention. It's when things are going wrong when people start paying attention. And so in many ways, a Trump presidency is a boom for them because it can provide funds for investigations or all kinds of stuff because people are just sitting there like figuring out what's going on.
Yeah, this is, you know, the New York Times, it's funny, I'm not a big fan of the president's tweeting. Not it's the particulars of it are incidental, although they play into it a little bit. It's just I just don't think presidents should be tweeting all the time. But that's a me thing. But I do love the failing New York Times, like failing New York Times. New York Times readership for the first time in ages is actually up, and CNN's viewership is up fairly significantly, almost certainly because of President Trump. I also like sad. As I said, I'm not a big fan of the tweets, but I do like, you know, we've used this in our own class last semester when the midterm average was about 65. He said, you know, government 310, midterm average 65, sad, failing 312, you know, so failing 310. So that won't happen this time. Let's move on to the state.
Yes.
You know, the regular session, regular legislation came to a close. And I just jotted down some things that they got done. They do have a state budget. So they did get a budget passed. Transportation, they did manage to set state regulations that would allow Lyft and Uber to come back. Now, the state didn't really have anything set on this, but certain locations, for instance, Austin and Houston, right? Houston had basically kind of set conditions and said, Lyft and Uber can only operate if you guys do these things. And Lyft and Uber said, we don't want to do those things, most notably criminal background checks for their drivers. And so Austin and Houston had bans on this. Well, the state stepped in and set a, you know, kind of statewide for Texas set of regulations to allow Lyft and Uber to operate. It's a little bit of a slap on the hand to the localities, but it's also in response to, you know, kind of public demand and sort of a request that there be some consistency with respect to the operating arrangements. Both Lyft and Uber want this, but other entities want it as well. There was some progress made on child protective services. The child protective services system in Texas has been a mess by objective accounts for quite a while. The foster care system here is in need of substantial reorganization, revamping. They began to make some progress on that, although from what I understand, a lot of progress needs to still be done. And then immigration. There was some legislation targeting sanctuary cities, some state clarification on immigration policy. So it was kind of interesting. A lot of these episodes, a lot of these issues, the state was coming in and clarifying, you know, what was otherwise being adjudicated at the local level. So there was a lot of talk about city versus state politics. But you notice there's a lot of stuff they didn't get done here. They didn't do anything on, there was some talk about marijuana, that the state would consider circumstances under which marijuana would be allowed. A lot of conservatives wanted tighter restrictions or clarified restrictions on abortion. There was clamor for more clarification on gun law and also clarification on transgender issues, including bathroom issues. None of those things got done during the regular session, which is why, one of the reasons, we have a special session. Professor McDaniel, how long do the special sessions last in Texas?
30 days.
So, who calls it? Governor Abbott. So, one of the things we'll reiterate throughout the semester is that Texas has every other year, there's a regular legislative session, you know, it runs. They try to get all the business of the state done. They rarely do. And so the governor has the power to call special sessions. The special sessions last 30 days. You may be asking, well, is there a limit? You know, can you only call on one?
Nope.
Governor Abbott can call as many consecutive special sessions as he sees fit until the business of the state, as he defines it, gets done. So we're just jotting this down beforehand. All right, now the ostensible reason for calling a special legislative session was sort of bullet point one here. Renew these five state agencies. So there are five state agencies in Texas, including the Texas Medical Association, whose terms are set to expire unless they are renewed. Right? And so Abbott said, look, you have to come back into session and renew these agencies. Beyond that, so that's kind of the main reason. But that's, in some sense, window dressing. He also laid out a list of at least 18 different issues he would like to see addressed in the legislative session, the special session. So, including, so that's the main bullet point, 18 other things. He said, I'd like to see you guys do something about property taxes. If you guys own property in Texas, first of all, congratulations. If your parents own property, also congratulations. But there is a limit on how quickly property taxes can escalate. There are a lot of people who said, like, well, it shouldn't be able. Yeah, I got that too. There's a lot of people who think that there ought to be a tighter limit on how much you can raise property taxes over a set period of time, right? They like to cap the increase at tax assessment value at a certain level. And conservatives always want to cap it lower. Liberals are always a little reluctant about cutting off the spigots, so because we do not have an income tax in Texas. There is no state income tax. In California, by the way, just for comparison, where I'm from originally, 18% state income tax. So for those of you who are, going to take a job in California, please, please bear our advice in mind. Factor income tax in when you're negotiating with your potential employer, right? We don't have that in Texas. We have sales tax and property tax. So property tax is also linked to the funding of the public schools. So some people say, I'm not so sure you want to cap that property tax rate in Texas. But, you know, as a property owner, I love education, so I'm down for that. I'd like more money for education, but I also own property, and oh man, it goes up and up and up around in Austin. So property tax is one issue. Transgender, Governor Abbott would like them to take up transgender and some kind of bathroom bill. Abortion, again, a lot of Abbott's conservative base would like to see more regulation or clarification, especially in the second trimester on abortion. There's also questions about what to do with fetal tissue and the restrictions on that. This is all part of the abortion issue that, you know, never seems to be reconciled in American politics. And then a lot of issues still regarding local power, ordinances that are out there where Abbott would prefer the state to come in and add some clarifying regulations. So, and many more, but these are just the highlights. Okay, so special session, it's going to run, when do we get this press meeting? July 18th,
yep.
Right, for 30 days. And then if they get a bunch of stuff done, maybe they go home, maybe Abbott calls another session, right? So
yeah, one of the things about the special session is that it allows gives the governor the power to set the agenda of the legislature. And so many people have talked about the governor of Texas not being as powerful as others. The governor of Texas moved up in the ranks in terms of power as time has gone on. But being able to call the special session and really dictate what will be on the special session is a way for the president to control the agenda, the legislative agenda, where he may not, or the governor may not have had the power beforehand. And so this is, you know, a lot of this is very important about, okay, one, taking care of the things that need to happen day to day. And you got to remember, Texas legislature only meets once every 2 years and for 6 months. And for a state as large as Texas, with as much going on, many people argue that that really doesn't make sense, that we should at least meet once a year to deal with the budget. You know, and so it deals with the budget, and then a bunch of other stuff happens. But with a state as large as this, as diverse as this, a lot of people argue must meet really once a year to deal with the budget. That really has not happened. It's once every 2 years. But again, if you look at a lot of stuff that's going on, is he's made it clear, like, here's the first thing you do, then here's a bunch of other stuff that I want you to get done. And it's really going to be interesting what happens and how much can actually be accomplished. And some of this you may say it's symbolic that Governor Abbott's putting it on the agenda just so he can show his base, I'm doing something, and may not really care if it passes or not. Whereas some of it might be stuff he's really concerned about is priority one. And it's clear priority one is dealing with the agencies that may lose their funding because of the sunset bills. And these are things to be very aware of. While we talk about national politics, state politics as well as local politics really has a more immediate effect on you. Yeah. So what President Trump does doesn't really affect you in terms of your property taxes, but what the governor decides, what the state legislature decides, or what the mayor decides has a huge effect on your property taxes, when trash is collected, these things that deal with your day-to-day life. And so be aware of those things and take some time to learn more about local and state politics, because those are the things that have the immediate effect on your lives.
Yeah, this is dovetailing with our discussion of federalism in the United States, right? That you know, we're not like Great Britain, we're not like some of these more unitary systems. And so, you know, Professor McDaniel and I were talking about this legislative session. They're considering property taxes, which directly affect all of us, right? Available revenue in your pocket, in your parents' pockets, et cetera. We're talking about annexation. I live in an area outside Austin that was annexed a couple of years ago. Their area is now Onion Creek, Rob Roy, you know, these places kind of on the periphery, the city of Austin, where Austin has annexation power. Austin wants to increase its tax base, right? They want to get that property tax money flowing in to the city of Austin, right? So, but what's the trade-off? If they annex an area that is formerly independent, well, then they are required to provide services to that area. So there's this interesting give and take, or pull and, you know, I guess pull and tug and pull, with these local communities who say, like, well, you know, you're gonna come and take our tax revenue, but, you know, we have a nice municipal utility district that takes care of our trash services, and now the city of Austin is gonna do it, and I heard you guys don't mow the lawns on the parks, and, you know, you don't really care much about tax stuff or about trash pickup and these. So, but this is the stuff, you know, whether your trash gets picked up, what's your property tax rate, funding for the schools. You know, Professor McDaniel, we're talking about this. UT, there's a big conversation out of this legislation. How did University of Texas do? They didn't re-regulate tuition. You know, they kind of made funds available, but we're a little bit in limbo. You know, all this kind of stuff directly affects, you know, our lives. And as you guys get a little older, first of all, you'll see these things more clearly, and also they'll touch on you more, right? As you own property taxes, as you have kids in the public schools, right? These sorts of things will really come home. So, and with a federal system, yeah, there's this stuff going on at the national level, it's consequential. But then there's the state stuff that's pretty consequential. And then there's this stuff, even, you know, what the legislature did affects whether you can get a ride on, for, you know, on Uber versus rideshare, you know, when you're on 6th Street some weekend, right? It's consequential, right? So, we wanted to mention a couple other things. First of all, next week, we're working on a special guest, possibly two, who are going to come with fresh polling information about attitudes of Texans towards some of these issues in the session, as well as more broadly. So we're working on that. That'll be cool. And we did want to say one thing about the responses to the first In the News segment. Your TAs said that you guys did a really good job on the whole. So excellent. To the extent that there's room for improvement, I think the consensus was that you're supposed to actually talk about something that you learned to connect it back up to some of the material that we're learning about in class. And so it's, you know, some of you maybe didn't get entirely full credit. It was because you just said, like, well, McDaniel and Shaw summarized X, right? We would like you to actually connect it up to some of the course material. So today we've talked about all these things, connected it to federalism, systems of government. You know, you do a little bit of that, you should be good to go. How are we doing? Are we good?
Yeah, I think that's all we have for today.
Yeah, it's like a half hour or so, a little long, but, you know, it's a busy week, right?
That's right.
All right. So until next week, good luck. Regular office hours today. I may leave a little early. I have Thursday office hours, 10:30 to 1:30. I may check out between 12:30 and 1. You know, if you need to meet with me, let me know. Otherwise, I've got a medical appointment I need to get out. You available?
I'll be around for a little bit, but I have to leave myself around 12:30.
Got to do it. All right, y'all. We'll see you next week.
The Government 310 In the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.